Thanks very much, Alan. Well, I split my time between my company, the Canadian Scotobiology Group, and the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada's Dark Sky Preserve Program, and I also write astronomy articles for Canada's Harold Smith magazine. By the way, Canadian Scotobiology, the word scotobiology is the study of the biological need for periods of darkness. And as you might imagine, based upon the topic of this interview, it really grew out of my concern about light pollution. Well, I've been an amateur astronomer for well over 50 years now. I'm a gray hair. And we, growing up, a bunch of us from high school used to be out under the night sky, meteor observing. And then our ambitions got the best of us, and we decided in our group to build a large telescope and sight it somewhere. And so we built it. It was sighted south of Ottawa. And then after a few years, somebody bought the property right next door to it and put up a house within 100 feet or so of the observatory. And they like to leave their outdoor lights on, and we had boisterous activity throughout the night any time of the week. So it didn't lead to any congenial, we weren't very good neighbors. So it was decided, since it was their home and this was our hobby, we decided to move. And we relocated west of Ottawa on Mississippi Valley Conservation Authority property. But still, Ottawa was in the eastern part of the sky, and the sky glow from Ottawa continued to rise up and contaminate our nice dark skies that we had there. So we're figuring, gosh, we got to move again, but we couldn't afford to move. So some of us got together and figured we'd try to do something. And we had a confluence of good talent and well-connected people, and we created a light pollution abatement program in Ottawa, and that proved to be relatively successful. This is going back to the mid-90s. And so we started with that, and it proved, as I said, it proved to be relatively successful. Then I was asked to take it over nationally, and here I was expecting to retire from it back in the late 1990s, and then I took on the national program for the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, and I've been going at it ever since. But what changed was in 2003, when I attended a conference in the Muskoka district north of Toronto, and there's about 80 to 100 people there, and only two of us had anything remotely to do with astronomy, and all the others were the biosciences, cognitive stuff, sociology, and so on. And that's when I found out that light pollution has very little to do with astronomy. It's got everything to do with biology, ecological integrity, and even human health. That's what you would think. At least that's the way it's been marketed, if I can use that word for this. But light enables monitoring of activity, but it alone doesn't provide security. The security depends upon three things. First, you have to detect a problem, or something has to detect a problem. And the second one is to report that there's a problem. And the third is to act on it. And unfortunately, all the light does is half of the first item, in that it enables you to see something happening, but it doesn't report it. Somebody has to report it, or a camera has to report it, and that report has to be then reviewed by someone or a machine that then sends out a signal to send somebody there to stop it, or at least to take a look at it. So because it only lights the property, it really puts the property on display. And a vandal or a thief can come in, they can see everything outside your house, and then they just pick up what they want, and in the morning the owner wakes up and finds their snowblower is gone, or their lawnmower is gone. So it really doesn't do what it's purported to do, but it's necessary to do the what comes next. So that's right, and in fact, the glaring lights can actually reduce visibility, because you can imagine someone on the street or waiting at a stoplight, waiting at a bus stop or something, and they're in a pool of light, and because it's so bright around them, they can't see into the shadows. And of course, that's where the criminal lurks, is in the shadow, to size up their prey. And then they come out, do their thing, and run off back into the shadows, and nobody knows. Nobody else notices it happen except the victim. And there's no way to, unless there's a security camera or someone with very good eyesight, because of the glare, you can't see very well. You can't even identify the person very well. Sure, as an amateur astronomer, we go out into the country, we set up telescopes because it's dark in the country, not very dark in the city. The city, if you walk around the neighborhood in the city, and then you walk around a gravel country road, there's a very different sense of the night. And it's not just the light, but in the city, it's quiet. You hear the hustle and bustle of the traffic in the distance. Whereas in the country, you hear the crickets, the frogs, the birds. You hear little rustles underneath the bushes. There's a lot of life out at night. In fact, 60% of life on Earth is nocturnal. So that's interesting. Why is it so different between the city and the country? Well, the city, of course, it's paved, it's got buildings and so on, and that's true. But it also has this always present light, so it sticks in your mind that the environment is different, and that's what's been touted in the press by most environmental organizations. In a city, you change the environment. And you change the habitat that is no longer suitable for a lot of animals. Well, you can drill down even deeper, because it's not just the general habitat, but it's actually light is part of the habitat. And when you add light, you change that habitat, and you change it so that the predators have an advantage over the prey. So you have less prey, and because the predators are more successful. And then with the prey getting eaten up for their dinners of the predators, then the predators disappear too. Then you have this unbalance in the ecosystem, and the ecosystem that's unbalanced, it's not a healthy way to be, a healthy environment. So when you go out into the country, when we take our telescopes out, we hear the crickets, the frogs. In some cases, we bring a little bit of music with us, because if there's a bit of music, then the animals, most of the foraging animals are pretty nervous, so they keep away from us. So we feel safer when we have a little bit of music, or we talk to each other if we're out in a group. So we've always known that there's something about the night, but it wasn't. But again, it's a different skill set, really. As amateur astronomers, I guess we're more interested in the physics than in the biology. And so when I went to this conference in 2003, my eyes were open to the impact on biology and biochemistry and behavior of animals. And again, that was pretty well a watershed of everything I've done for the following 17 odd years. That's a good question, because there's conflicting reports on it, surprisingly. But if you drill down into the actual literature that they're based upon, the reports are based on, there's some biases in who writes the report. I suppose if I wrote a report, my point of view would be biased as well. But it depends what you're comparing. And you can compare, for example, let's just use the idea of birds and these navigation avoidance beacons that are on towers. The reports are that the white strobe beacons don't impact the birds, whereas the red beacons did. But the red beacons are much easier on the eyes. But what they're using is historical data for the red beacons, and the red beacons used to be incandescent lights that took time to heat up and then cool down. So they wasn't a strobe, it was more of a low-frequency flash. And as a driver, when you're going along, say, the 401 or the 417 or highways in the country, if you you can pass by some of these towers that have the strobe lights on, and you notice there's a flash in the side of your eye off the distance, but it's hard to localize on it because it's so short. Whereas the red beacons, you could zero in on where the beacon is. And therefore that got your attention. You knew where the beacon was. So if you are a bird, you say, oh, what's that? Then it knows the direction to fly to go to it. So that's why the red beacons tended to attract more birds, the interest of more birds. The white strobes, which are actually more disruptive to the environment, the only reason they don't attract birds is because they're on such a short period of time and they can't localize on it. So what they decided was that, well, then white lights are fine because the birds aren't attracted by them. Well, that's not really true. So one has to be very careful about even scientific reports. There can be, they might be not comparing what you really want to know. And this is just one example. And it's not that the researchers had that in mind. They were actually consciously biased. But the researchers just only look so deep into what they're after. They were given a contract or whatever, and they did their research. And the next edition of the research would be to look at these other issues. But then it becomes their interests drift to other things, and they don't do the follow-up research, or other people don't have the funding to do follow-up research. There's always good reasons why things are not studied. So it's a matter of reading even scientific papers and technical reports. Read them critically, because if something isn't right with you, then chances are it's not right. It doesn't have to be rocket science to explain something. Usually things are, especially when it comes to biology and behavior, they're pretty straightforward, unless you want to come up with numbers for calculate specifics. Yeah, that starts to go down a rabbit's hole. But there's a lot of a lot of what is done now is based upon what we've been doing for 50 years. But the science has changed so quickly in the last two decades, it's remarkable. And that's, first of all, something that you might be worried about, because quick science usually is kind of dirty science, and that it needs to be cleaned up by follow-up studies and so on. But it seems to, the research seems to be pretty consistent and buttresses the idea that artificial light at night is not good for the environment or human health. And to put this in a more common sense context, our genes evolve very slowly. So really, genetically, we're hunter-gatherers. And anything that deviates from the hunter-gatherer environment, diet for that matter, is probably not good for us. Well, as a hunter-gatherer, the only night light you might have had would be a fire. And fire emits very, very little blue light. The temperature of the coals is just too low to emit much blue light. Well, back in the late 20th century, early part of the 21st century, the early 2000s, there's detectors in our eye that were discovered. Actually, they were discovered back in the 1980s, I think it is. But then studies had to work on, what are they? They characterize them. And they're not visual. They don't provide an image, but they do detect light. And they're sensitive to the blue part of the spectrum. And this is curious, why the blue part of the spectrum? Well, think back as a hunter-gatherer, you want to stay alert throughout twilight, because that's when the predators of the day and the predators of the night overlap. So it's a particularly dangerous time of year, and time of day. And so you need to stay alert, and these detectors detected the blue light of the sky. And they kept, as long as it detected the blue light of the sky, it kept them alert. They wouldn't let the inhibited sleeping to a certain degree. When the light falls beneath their threshold, then that locks in the circadian rhythm that does all kinds of things I'll mention. And these detectors, the spectral sensitivity or the color sensitivity is based upon the blue light of the night sky or the twilight, the blue light of twilight. Well, if you have artificial light around that emits that light, your body is going to feel it's in perpetual twilight. Now, these light detectors, they enable the flow of a whole suite of hormones, because as a hunter-gatherer, you've got a pretty stressful and dangerous daytime as you go out hunting and just being hunted. So you have to, you can't have things going on in your body that's going to inhibit your prowess as a hunter or survivor. So there's a lot of damage that occurs in the daytime, and that has to be repaired so that you can survive the next day. And these repairs, or your body needs to be rejuvenated, and that rejuvenation occurs at night. And so when the twilight falls beneath the threshold of these non-visual cells, we'll call them twilight detectors, then that enables the flow of melatonin that puts you to sleep, and the melatonin enables the flow of this other suite of hormones that go about your body to repair it. Well, if you have perpetual twilight, the melatonin and these other hormones don't get released, or at least they just trickle out into your blood. But these hormones have a limited shelf life, and after a few hours, they atrophy and get reabsorbed. So if you have twilight throughout the night that comes from white street lights and door lights and the lights from your personal communication devices and so on, then that inhibits the flow of these hormones. And even though you may sleep, you don't get the full benefit of sleep. And so what do we find? We find that human health, the natural health of humans, is decreasing over time. And surprisingly, some of the things that go uncontrolled are obesity, diabetes, cancer, stress, anxiety. All these things can be linked back to artificial light at night. This doesn't say that artificial light causes these things, but rather it prevents the body from repairing itself and coping with them. Well, I think this is where scotobiology came in, because because the humans are diurnal. They're not very good at night, but we have a social imperative, it seems, or cultural imperative, to extend our activity into the night. But as diurnal creatures, we don't see all that well at night. Now, amateur astronomers and professional astronomers know that they can, because we do it. We can walk across a farmer's field under starlight. We need very, very little light to see. And indeed, all humans do. But if you live in a city, your eyes are never dark adapted. So you never experience how well you can see at night. So yes, there's actually two types of, I mentioned this non-visual set of detectors, but there are two other ones that support our vision. In the daytime, it's very bright. We have cells that resemble the shape of cones, and there's three types of them. One type is sensitive to blue light, in fact, the blue light of twilight, and then the other two, one is sensitive to the green-yellow part of the spectrum, and the third one is sensitive to the orange-red part of the spectrum, and this gives us our color vision. They're not very sensitive to light, but they see very fine detail. And so, curiously, the structure of your eyes evolve based upon the imperative of the time. And as hunter-gatherers, we're concerned about things that are horizontal along the horizon, whether it's a wildebeest or whatever it might be. We have to know the azimuth, where things are, so we can go off and hunt them. But our perception vertically really wasn't all that important. So it turns out that the way your eye works is it resolves things very fine in the horizontal direction, but not so fine in the vertical direction. And I thought that was, I never really knew about that until I was looking at a double a star in the sky. It's actually in the summer sky. And it's called the double-double in the constellation of Lyra, the harp. And you could look at these two stars in the eyepiece, and one star would be split horizontally, so you saw two, but you only saw one. The other one was a single star. But if you rotated your head 90 degrees, the initial pair that were split, you couldn't split anymore, but the first pair that you couldn't see split before now was split. So you could rotate your head 90 degrees, and you could resolve them and unresolve them. It was kind of curious. I figured, well, that doesn't make sense. So I figured something was wrong with my eye. I was getting a migraine or something. But it turned out that that's the case. Well, there are other. So we've got this, the cone cells in the daytime, but they're not sensitive enough to see at night. And yet it's critical as a species that we see at night, at least as hunter-gatherers. So millions of years ago, the eyes of mammals also developed another type of receptor. In fact, they evolved from the cones to that were very, very sensitive. And they are rod-shaped. And there's about 10 of them that get grouped together in a neural network in the back of your eye. And they're extremely sensitive, but they don't see color. So you end up use these at night. Now these rod cells are very easily bleached by light. They take a while to recover. And you can experience this when you go to take out the garbage or so. You go from the brightly lit kitchen out to the dark, and what you end up seeing is nothing. But if you linger a bit of time outside, you'll notice you start seeing more and more, and this is the recovery of your night vision. The night vision cells, these rod cells, become more and more sensitive the bleached portion of them, the bleachness of them recovers, and they begin to see again. So after about 10 minutes, you can see reasonably well, but if you really want to see a faint galaxy in a telescope, you might need 30 minutes to an hour. In fact, there's improvements after 3 hours. Your vision is still improving. So, never using these, and most people are oblivious to them. If I may give a bit of a... I don't think there's any copyright problems on this thing, but back in the day, for most of us that have white hair, probably remember the Moody Blues. And on one of their albums, Days of Future Past, there's a There's a bit of a poem they recite, and it was written by one of the members who was actually a member of the British Astronomical Association, and it goes, it's talking about the moon, but it's cold-hearted orb that rules the night, removes the colors from our sight. Red is gray and yellow white, but we determine which is right and which is an illusion. And this is a direct reference to being dark adapted, because when you're dark adapted, you see, but you don't see color. Well, it's interesting that the moon comes around once a month. So, yet the animals, and the moon's been around since the Earth formed, so the animals have adapted to that. They still exist, they thrive. So, complete darkness, indeed, a medical doctor once at this conference suggested that you need complete darkness. I didn't believe that, because the moon comes around, and there's aurora if you're northern, in the northern, if you're close to higher latitudes in the north and the south. So there must be something else to it. When we started looking into scotobiology, the impact of light, it was evident that the animals, and this was reported in other literature, animals have a plasticity in their behavior and their biology. They tolerate variations, and you can appreciate that sometimes you have a really dark day. Sometimes it's a bright day when it's clear. Sometimes soon after sunset it's really dark. Sometimes it's the light seems to linger, and that's because of the clouds in the horizon. It goes on and on. And yet and also when you go from season to season, the length of night changes dramatically. So all the animals can all life has adapted to accept, in fact, even take advantage of these variations. So having an absolutely no light is not really realistic. And it's also not very practical given our interest in having night light. So when we looked at the scotobiology side, it was evident that there's a tolerance to the brightness of light, the extent of the light, the spectrum of the light, and also when the light occurs. And these were written up and documented into the Canadian Guidelines for Outdoor Lighting that were written and adopted by Parks Canada, or sorry, written by myself and were adopted by Parks Canada in 2008 and now form the lighting protocol for Canadian dark sky preserves. And also, they're offered as guidance for the International Dark Sky Association and other groups around the world. And so, if you look critically at these attributes of light that life, that animals and even human health, through human health, humans can tolerate, you can have light. It's almost like having your cake and eat it too. Because if you abide by the shielding, the color and so on, then you can actually have a remarkable amount of light. You can actually read. And that's about the most extreme requirement for lighting. You should at least be able to read instructions, read a map. And if you can do that, then really at night, you don't need much more light than that. And so when we put these guidelines together, we then compared them to some of the Illumination Engineering Society of North America, their guidelines for street lighting and so on. And they're not that far off, which really surprised me. However, and there's always a caveat here, those guidelines just talk about light. They don't talk about the shielding, they don't talk about the color, and they don't talk about the duration or the scheduling of the light. Well, if shielding in terms of to limit the extent of the light, because when you shine light on the ground, it will be contaminated to a certain degree, so you want to limit the contamination as much as possible. And also, if you don't have a shield on a light, that light can be seen for literally as far as the eye can see. And that disrupts the environment, it disrupts the navigation of animals, especially birds. And yet it's providing no illumination whatsoever. Because you hold up a light a piece of paper a kilometer from a light, you can't read anything on that piece of paper. It's better to limit it to only where you want it. For example, on the road or on your property. So Yes, but the way it's expressed by the Illumination Engineering Society is that there's no for what they characterize one type of shielding as full cutoff, and that limits the light, so there's no uplight, and it limits the light that's just below the horizon to about 10% the output of the lamp. And so that's actually pretty good compared to what we used to have. We used to have the Cobra lights that had that drop glass, and then they evolved into newer products that had a flat glass, kind of looked like a Cobra light on a diet. Street lighting, that's right. But that 10% of the light shining out horizontally or just below the horizon can literally shine for hundreds and hundreds of meters. And so when you look around, you look down a street that has even full cutoff lighting, you still see the bright glare from the window of the light, the street light. And that is affecting your vision. That's causing your, in some cases, your iris to stop down so that you let less light into your eye, and that sounds counterproductive. So you want to limit it as much as possible. So the shielding is important, and there's a more aggressive shielding called sharp cutoff shielding that reduces that light in the horizon, just below the horizon, to only 1%. So there's ways you can handle this, but the ISNA, their guidelines, RP8 they're called, limit only the illumination of the ground and also the luminance of the light, how much light comes out of the light fixture and off the ground, reflects off the ground. So if you are more careful about the shielding, and then also if you're careful about the color of the light, because white light is composed of all colors, but especially in the modern LED lights, it's primarily white light and amber light, and you balance these to make the light look whiter or warmer or whatever it might be. And that blue light provides our impression of glare by about 5 to 10 times more than an amber light would. That's why white LED lights look so much more glaring than the old-fashioned high-pressure sodium. Even though the old high-pressure sodium optics were very poor, the shielding was harder to do with those lamps. So by removing the blue light and providing better shielding, and then only using the light when there's a lot of humans around, you can actually reduce the amount of impact on the environment considerably. And also by removing the glare that comes from poor shielding or limited shielding, you can now use much fainter lights as well. They don't have to be as bright, and not as bright translates into saving energy. So if that's right, and also they become very dynamic. They're one reason for having the light along streets as bright as they are. Is for safety, and yet so they want to have the illumination level into your daytime range, because those daytime cone cells respond more quickly than your nighttime rod cells. However, and this is a matter of the rod cells might respond respond in the order of about half a second, whereas your cone cells respond in less than a quarter second. So that's significant for drivers, I suppose. I'm not a traffic expert. However, the distractions on the side of the road reduce your reaction time, increase your reaction time to over 2 seconds. So really, the illumination level has no effect. It's all to do with distraction on the side of the road. And that's, of course, what is part of retail marketing. You got to have the flashing dynamic lights and in-your-face advertising on the side of the road. That's what... They do. And it's that's because your iris is stopping down. If it stops down too, I don't know if the right word is vigorously, but it causes pain. So in some cases, that physical pain is a stopping down of your iris, of limiting the light that goes into your eye, which again is counterproductive because you want, it's nighttime, you're supposed to let the light in your eye. Well, that stuff stops it down. And another point is that the most visual studies were done on at universities, and universities, they use the cheap labor for tests are undergraduate students. So they used relatively, well, young compared to us, young kids were the subjects for the test subjects. And so a lot of the lighting that's designed now or that's in best practice are based upon 20-year-olds. And unfortunately, your eyesight changes dramatically after 40 years. As hunter-gatherers, we rarely live longer than 40 years old. And so I tend to tell people that our bodies have a warranty, and the warranty expires at 40. And everything else is luck after that. And so, and that includes vision. Our vision decays, our accommodation changes, and so on and so on. Yeah, the complexity comes in understanding why, but people are generally pretty smart. I mean, people that own homes are typically have been around for 30, 40, 50 years. They've seen a lot of life, and I give them credit that they probably know how to think, and they can think critically. So if they think critically when they put up light, I think they can pretty well solve a lot of the problems. For example, use as little as possible. That's something that maybe grew out of my parents' age, where there weren't many things, so that you had to pick, and they had very few resources, so that you didn't have the money to just buy wildly. So they were very careful, very stingy, if you will, with what they did. And I learned that from them. But if you use as little light as possible, in other words, put up a light, don't put up the maximum brightness light because it was cheap, but put in the maybe the intermediate or even the lowest wattage light. And if you don't have glare around, especially in the urban, the rural areas, if there's no other lights around, you can get by with even the lowest wattage light for a door light is probably going to be too bright. So that's important. Avoid white lights. Now, I know there's a lot of, essentially, you go to a hardware store, they've got the brightest, whitest, bluest lights up there, and they say the greatest thing since apple pie. But I suggest they go to the other part of the department, I guess it's in the seasonal portion, and buy bug lights. The bug lights are amber. They don't attract mosquitoes, which is good. You don't want to let people enter your house, and when they come in, a cloud of mosquitoes come into your house. So use a bug light. This is something my grandfather taught us. You put bug lights near your doors and so on, and what you'll find is the bug lights are nowhere near as glaring as modern white lights, and they also don't attract the mosquitoes. This is a good point, because as we learn more about lights and the technology evolves, 10 years ago you couldn't get 4,000K lights. Now they're falling off the shelves, but now we also know that 4,000K emit far too much blue light. In fact, 5 to 10 years ago, the International Dark Sky Association was recommending 3K, which is white, but there's less blue light in it. But now you can get 2700K, 2500K, and if you get 2200K, that's getting pretty close to bug lights. It's even beyond warm. It's more like the terms warm light and cool light and so on. I hate to say this. This is for the people that don't know anything about light. What's important of your brain is what puts this color, the image in your mind. You give a word to that. It might be warm or cool, white. But your body responds to the spectrum. And so what you want to do is minimize the blue part of the spectrum. Well, what kind of color temperature would that be? Because that's, as you point out, it's not a black body, so you can't really apply a temperature. But marketing people, they do. So what you want to get from the hardware store is 2200K or less. And that emits between about 5 and 1% blue light. And yet, if you get a 2200K, it looks like candlelight. I mean, there's nothing wrong with candlelight. It's rather nice. And it's also better for your eyes. It doesn't attract bugs as much. And on top of that, if you put up a door light, make sure it's shielded so it doesn't shine into the eyes of people walking by your house or motors driving along the street. If you shield it, it's illuminating your doorstep, your door, and so on, the pathway up to the door. It's not shining in their eyes. That's going to inhibit that visibility. And also, I think so, that it makes that area glow more, the surface glow. And also, the bug lights won't, they're designed not to attract bugs, but if the bug can see the lamp, it's a very intense light and they get attracted to that. Whereas if you shield it, then the mosquitoes can't see it when they're 100 meters away. It comes with the design of the coach lights. Now, there's some municipalities that don't allow lights along the curb. And that's because motors can't see past that light. So you can have a dog, you could have a ball, you could have a raccoon crossing the street beyond that coach light, and the motors won't see it. Or at least they'll be distracted by the light rather than by the animal or the hazard that's in the road. So that teaches us something. Some municipalities say you shall not have curbside lighting. However, there's a neighbor of mine out in the country. He had coach lights, and what I ended up doing was there's two halves to it, that the top half would fold off so you can change the light bulb. And so I put shields, metal shields, on the top half, and I use one of these fittings you can get from Canadian Tire that extends or that shifts the light bulb higher. And that moved it from the lower half of the cavity to the upper half. So no light shone. So essentially it was better than full cutoff light. And the metal I was using was reflecting light down, and it illuminated the entrance to his laneway better. And so there are modifications to do, but there are indeed some lights that are designed to be far better than the unshielded lighting. But you have to look for them, and unfortunately they used to be the premium lights. Now they're much more common because of the people know more about the impact of light pollution. There's a handbook or a manual or a document that has all the lots and lots of full cutoff lights in it that you can buy or order through hardware stores. And if people email me, then I can send them this the link. It's on the internet. I can send the link to it. It's rather one of these long URLs. But it was produced by the Bruce Peninsula Biosphere people, when they about the time when they became a dark sky preserve. And it's a very helpful, though it's a very old, but it's a very helpful document if you want to try to find lights. But generally speaking, if you buy a light from a hardware store, it probably isn't full cutoff. If it is, good. If not, then you have to do something to shield it. Now, fortunately, CFL lights, compact fluorescent lights, and LED lights, they tend to be very cool, relatively cool, especially compared to an incandescent bulb. And you can literally make a shade out of a piece of cardboard, paint it with some outdoor, durable outdoor paint, and that'll last 5 years. And it's a great project for your kids or grandkids. And again, on my website, there's or one of my websites, but if somebody emailed me, I can send them the drawing on how to make it. I think I might have been. It used to be called artificial light. No, they used to be called light at night, LAN. And I said, well, it's artificial light at night. Then the U.S. Park Service got wind of that, and it's and some of their consultants, and they rightly pointed out that there's no such thing as artificial light. Light is light. So I had to eat crow. And so they came up with a term, and I use it now, artificial, and in brackets, anthropogenic. It's a long word, but hey, it's got some meat behind it. So it's actually anthropogenic light at night. But yes, I conned it. And also it raises eyebrows because say, what's this? Who's Alan? And but in principle, it should be pronounced A-L-A-N, but anyway, that's the way it is. There's another something that people can do when it comes to reducing light pollution. We talked about using the lowest wattage, avoid white lights. In fact, there's a color filter. If you do have white lights, and gosh, you just bought them last week and you don't want to replace them, there's a color filter that you can get, and it's really cheap in terms of inexpensive. And some photographers out there are aware of this company. They're bhphotovideo.com, and it's an American photographic video store, and they sell products from a company called Rosco, and the product is Rosco Lux, and it's number 15 deep straw. And these things, it's you get 2 square feet for about, I think, $7 US. I mean, it's an enormous amount, and you put one piece of this inside your light, and suddenly you got amber light. And it's very cheap. It's not terribly durable, so it's got to be protected, and maybe you have to get some piece of clear plastic and sandwich it between this clear plastic. But generally, if the light fixture you have has a bit of a window in it, then just put it on top of the window between the window and the lamp, and you're good. And if it can't take high temperature, so it doesn't work with incandescent lights, but it'll work fine with CFL and LEDs. That's the cheapest way to go. And it also, gives you a sense of satisfaction when you turn something that's bad for the environment into something that's good for the environment. The shielding is we've talked about. And the other part is to turn the lights off at night. Getting back to scotobiology, because of the variation in the length of when sunset occurs from almost 9 o'clock, depending on where your listeners are, can be even later than that, down to maybe 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the animals understand that change, and indeed they exploit that change to predict when determine when they should prepare for winter. And so if you look at the traffic records and use the traffic records as a proxy for human activity, then 2 hours after sunset is a pretty good time when the light should be turned off. And with that in mind, 2 hours after sunset or 10:30, something like that. That's a pretty good time when you can start turning your lights off or dimming them down, program them to dim them down, because the animals can accommodate that somewhat. Ideally, as soon as you go into your house, if you don't expect visitors and you don't expect to go out again, turn the lights off anyway. Animals use anonymity for safety and security, and so why don't we? So a vandal isn't going to vandalize your property, spray stuff, if no one's going to see their artwork. So if you turn your lights off, you know, why bother? They'll go to the next door neighbor who's left their lights on. Yeah, the lights, you're going to be sleeping and your property's on display. If you do use motion detectors, then the fact that the lights pop on, that's a pretty good visual alarm for yourself. If you leave your blinds open, you'll see the lights pop on around your house, and your neighbors might as well. And so that's far better than providing, a vandal needs to carry a flashlight, so that reduces what they can do by a factor but to a half. Whereas if they use both hands, they can do whatever they want. Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Ellen.